When she was 18, her father gave her the advice she needed to follow her dreams and become a writer. The next day, he had a heart attack and died in her arms. She did become a writer and a business owner and then a wife and mother. Today, after 13 books, a million of them in print, she's an award-winning syndicated columnist, a radio and TV host, and the owner of two successful companies. And now, Elise is here to help you rebuild your life. Stay tuned. This is gonna be good. This is the Elise Glink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours.
Welcome back to the Elise Glink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours on WSB, 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK, online all the time, thinklink.com. thinklink.com. And don't forget to follow me on Twitter, where we're already beginning today's conversation, at Glink, at G-L-I-N-K. So I'm just back from a trip with my family, and we were celebrating my 25th wedding anniversary, which was earlier this week, and my 50th birthday. I've been a member because of him for through AARP for a while. But I didn't see my card turn up, so maybe I'm not really 50. But the third thing we're celebrating is my son Alex going off to college in a couple of weeks. And most of his friends have already gone. His new school is on the trimester system, and so he doesn't start until mid-September. But it has brought back, and we've been seeing all summer, you know, the idea that he's really going off on his own. He's going to be 19 in a couple of weeks. And it's been time all summer for us to have these conversations about, you know, now that he's 18, and I talked about this last year when he turned 18, that he's now officially considered an adult in the eyes of the government and for many things like, you know, having to sign his own name to legal documents. He can do that now. Have his own credit card. You know, there's just a lot of different things that he can do and that he needs to do. And going off to college is a time for many of us with our kids where we hope that all of the lessons that we've imparted to them about credit, about being careful with the dollars that you earn and even more careful with the dollars that you spend, that we hope all of these lessons come to fruition in a way that's going to make sense going forward. And so when I look at Alex and his younger brother, Michael, but Michael's only 16, so we're going to leave him aside for a moment. But when I look at Alex, I see a young man who's very thoughtful about money, for whom, just like many of the people who are digital millennials, members of this digital generation, not that interested in material possessions, doesn't seem that interested in doing things that are expensive, very interested in spending a whole lot of time in front of his computer. So he's very interested in technology. But it isn't, he's not running around and spending like a wild man. And still, you know, going off to college is, let's talk about what your basic expenses are going to be. And so this conversation for us got framed around how many meals he should take at college. There are different meal plans that are offered. And at his school, you can take like seven meals a week plan, right? That would be dinner every night. And then you could do a 14 meal a week or a 19 meal a week. The idea being that you sleep through brunch. There's only brunch on Saturday and Sunday, and you're sleeping through breakfast. So that's sort of interesting. So we said, well, this is a good way for you to think about how you are going to spend money. And the way that the school works is it costs the same whether you go with 7 meals, 14 meals, or 19 meals. You just get extra dollars to spend at, you know, other places like the local coffee shop or the bread bake or wherever they, you know, have food. And you can use some of your college dollars to do that. But when we talked about how much it would actually be, it was a really interesting lesson for him, because the difference between the 14 meal a week and the 19 meal a week, the difference in these extra dollars that they give you, it's about $150. And we said to Alex, how far will $150 go for a quarter? Because that's the difference, right? It's 14 meals a week versus 19 meals a week, right? So an extra 5 meals a week. Or you could get $150 per quarter, 3 months. I said, that's not going to take you. If just assume you go get a hot chocolate in the morning And a bagel, you've probably used up $7 or $8, and that is very close to about 7-8% of everything you have to do for the quarter. And by the end of the following week, you're going to not have any money left. You're going to be pretty hungry. So he opted for the 19-meal-a-week plan, which we think is exactly right. But it was a great conversation opener. It was one of those moments where you can start to actually put on paper and pen what things cost, right, and how much you eat, and start to think about in a very real way what that would cost you day in and day out and how quickly you would burn through the $150 worth of dollars that they would give you, and why the $19 meal a week plan is a much better deal. So these kinds of moments are the moments you have to be looking for as a parent, regardless of whatever age your kids are, right? You've got to be looking for those moments to be able to enlighten them as to what the reality of life is. And you have to be able to explain it in a way that even for a smart kid, and Alex is super, super bright, right? But you have to be able to explain these dollars and cents issues, the day-to-day numbers, in a way that makes sense. And I found that in my years of trying to help people understand dollars and cents, that if you break it down into something that they appreciate, like, say, a hot chocolate and a bagel, in other words, you bring the conversation to the place where their minds are, everybody is able to understand what numbers mean. And when people say to me, I'm not really a money person, I'm not really dollars number, I can't do finances, I always say to them, really? So what happens when you go to a grocery store? Or what happens when you go to your local Starbucks? Or what happens when you have to decide what health plan you need? Breaking down money into biteable chunks is really the whole essence of managing your money. And it's something that, as Alex is getting ready to leave, that we've sort of said to him, you need to think about this now. It's time for you to set up an account on, you know, Quicken.com, if that's the one you're going to use, or Mint.com, right, which is now owned by Intuit, and start to track what you spend, what you have, what you earn, and see how it's all going to work out for you, because dollars are limited. And until you start to really earn money, you know, we have limited dollars. Everybody in the world, except maybe Bill Gates and apparently Bloomberg, has limited dollars. So you've got to make smart choices all the way through. And if you start early when you're 19 and 18 and 17 and 16 making really smart choices with your money, you're going to have enough of it as life goes on, because you're always going to be able to make the tough decisions. You're always going to be able to look closely at it. So if you've got children or grandchildren who are getting ready to go off to school and you're looking for ways to have these kinds of conversations about what's going on with their money, these are the moments you want to look for. Look for them, engage with them, take out a pen and paper and just kind of do the math. It's all addition, subtraction, multiplication, and division with a little bit of percents. Anybody can do it. Any basic calculator can do it. Any calculator online can do it. And for sure, your kids can do it. You just have to help them see the road. 404-872-0750. Rosalind joins me on the line from Duluth. Good morning, Rosalind.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you.
What can I do for you today?
I am needing to sell my home. I need to downsize. I've had some health issues, and I went the route of getting an investor. So I have an investor, and I'm just trying to find out, how do you figure out if that's a good option for you? The reason why I chose investor as opposed to traditional sale, but because of my illness, I didn't want to go through the showing and having to leave the house and all of that. So I opted this other route, and I'm trying to get your take on that.
Well, how did you find this so-called investor? What did you do?
Actually, I had two investors. One was a realtor who also invests. So I found out from him how much he would offer, and then the whole process. And then I found another one through some other I guess investors that I knew, they told me about somebody else. So I had two offers in essence.
Okay. And how much is your house actually worth if you were to sell it in the open market?
I've been told, I've had an appraisal done last year, and it was at, I think, 340, mm-hmm. Like that. And that was last June. And then this year, some homes similar to mine have sold in like the 388 range. However, they've done a lot of updates, some things that I have not done.
Okay. And how much did the realtor offer you?
The realtor offered, she offered $265 cash, and then he offered a $310 with the owner financing.
Okay. So I assume this is without a broker's commission.
Well, he took out the broker's commission.
What do you mean by that?
When he did the breakout, this is the realtor, when he did the breakout, he took 3% from when he goes to sell the property, which I didn't think that should come out of the numbers, but he said that that's customary that you take the 3% out because he has to pay that when he sells the property himself.
I don't understand why you have to pay for his investment costs, but I really don't understand, Roslyn, why you're so willing to leave money on the table. So I don't know what your illness is, but you've got an offer for $310 with owner financing. I don't know why you would even take any of the risks on this. What did the other investor offer you?
The other investor, he's just given an offer of $291 because there are two properties for sale, one next door and one across the street. And so I haven't even counter-offered that one. I just wanted to, get some other advice and also to find something else, which I have not found, and that can help to guide, my decision.
So we need to take a quick break. Can you hang on? Because I want to go through this a little bit with you, and I'm a little bit concerned about how easily you're willing to part with these with this money, because if you had an appraisal last, if some houses that are similar to yours sold for $388, even if you didn't do all the work, but let's say it's an extra $25,000 of work, you should still be at somewhere over $350, and you're willing to part at $310 with owner financing, which puts much of the risk on you, and I don't quite understand why that is. So let's come back and talk about it a little bit more. 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. I'm Elise Gling. Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours on WSB. It's 25 minutes past the hour on the Elise Gling Show, Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours, 404-872-0750. We've been talking to Roslyn from Duluth about her property, her current residence. She has health issues, and she went the route of finding two investors. The appraisal last year, the property was at $340. Other properties in the area this year have sold for close to $390. She was offered $265 and then $310,000, but if she does owner financing, and she wants to know whether it's a good deal or not. And Rosalind, my concern for you is that, and I understand wanting to be expedient about it and not, if you're sick or have something that really prevents you from getting out of the house regularly and cleaning up after it, I certainly understand that. But there are a lot of investors out there who would be willing to buy something, and I'm concerned about you getting these two investors who are offering you and maybe leaving $20,000, $25,000 on the table. And it seems like, if you're in an area where the houses are selling for nearly $400,000, even if yours is in less good shape, right, there may still be more money to wring out of this and not let it go so easily. So here's what I would love to see you do. I would love to see you talk to a couple of other realtors who are in the area and sell a lot of property where you are in your neighborhood. And I'd like you to talk to them about what they think that they would list your home for and where they think it would reasonably sell for. So to do a comparative marketing analysis and then understand if their pricing is different from, and you want to talk to them not just about where they're listing it, but where they're going to end up. And so to get there, you need to look at the comps, the sales prices of other homes similar to yours in similar condition in the neighborhood and where they've sold for. And if they tell you that the properties have sold for, let's say, $350, but then you have to take a 6% commission off of that, right, you may still wind up at $315 or $320, and then you can go back to your investor and say, you know what, I'd feel really comfortable at $320, but I want $320, and anything that you have to do on top of it, I'm not going to finance you, this is what it is. And you can go back to the other one as well. If those don't work out, you can go back to the realtors you've talked to, and you can say to them, look, I think that this is where I'd like to be, and this is how much I think that, you know, you based on what you've told me, what I've looked at in the neighborhood, this is what I think I can get, and let's start this process, bring all of your investor offers. The final thing that you can do is list the property for sale at auction.com. Auction.com is a huge investment site and would be, it's a place where so much attention is focused that you may be able to get the very most money from it at the top. So good luck, and let me know what happens, Rosalind. It is 28 minutes past the hour on the Elise Glink Show, Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours on WSB.
Try to stay cool this weekend and join us early for Atlanta's Morning News Monday. I'm Scott Slate. We'll check traffic every 6 minutes, and Kirk Mellish's five-day forecast will help you plan the week, a break of the heat, and the best rain chance days, Monday morning on WSB.
It's 36 minutes past the hour on the Elise Glink Show, Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours on WSB. 404-872-0750 is our number here at the station, 1-800-WSB-TALK. In a couple of minutes, I'm going to take this call with Jim next, but in a couple of minutes, I want to talk about brand new changes that were announced in the FICO scoring model, and I want to give you some behind-the-scenes intel and how these different scoring models actually work and what the changes are going to mean for you. But that's only if the lenders adopt it, the creditors adopt the new FICO scoring model. So we'll talk about that coming up next. 404-872-0750. Get ready with your credit questions. Jim joins me on the line from Woodstock. Hi, Jim.
Morning, Elise. How are you?
I'm doing fine. How are you?
Excellent. Quick question for you. My wife and I are looking at very strongly for purchasing an investment property in Panama.
Mm-hmm.
Though we can easily afford the investment, we'd like to see if there's something available, maybe like a 2 or 3 year short-term mortgage or a note that we could get to would help us preserve our capital for a bit. And I'd envision putting maybe a third of it down up front.
Well, Panama is really interesting. How did you decide on Panama before we get into the details of it?
We've been down in Central America at least a dozen times, and we've been there several times here in the last year, and that's going to be our new home base for us.
So Panama is really interesting because it's grown so tremendously over the last decade, and it's really a very modern city now with some beautiful amenities. I know some people who have moved there from Brazilians, and they decided to retire to Panama. There's a lot to like about it. It's not that far from the U.S. It's got, do you speak Spanish fluently?
I'm working at it.
Working at it. Muy bien, or as they say, bien hecho. So there's a lot to like about it. It's a very cosmopolitan city. It's got, you know, it hasn't had a coup in a while. But, you know, it's a very interesting place to go. Are you going to maintain your residence here in the United States?
Probably not.
Mm-hmm. And when are you thinking of selling the place you live in now?
2 to 3 years.
And is it paid off?
No.
How much equity do you have in that property?
Boy, rough guess, maybe $25,000.
Okay. So not terribly much.
Mm-hmm.
Because the easiest thing would be to take out the mortgage on the U.S. property.
Yeah.
And use that as the cash to put down on the new property down in Panama and in Central America.
Mm-hmm.
Mortgages in Latin America tend to be a much higher price point, and they tend to require more of a down payment. As you know, putting down a third is probably the minimum amount. The interest rates tend to be higher. In Mexico, just a regular mortgage on property might be 10 to 15%. When my husband was growing up in Mexico City, if you could even get a mortgage, the interest rate might have been as high as 25, 30, or 40%. So the differences are pretty extreme. I think if I were you, I would want to talk to some different people down there about property prices and values. Have you thought about renting before you buy?
Yeah, we've already been through all those discussions, and when we this would be an investment property, so when we actually go down there, absolutely, we'll rent first before we buy a new residence.
Okay. And this one is supposed to defray costs, so other people will rent it out from you, U.S. people, or are you going to do it down there?
No, we will do it down there.
Okay. And so I'm interested in understanding a little bit about the numbers that they're offering you. Is this like a vacation club residence that's run by a U.S. company, or is this a Panamanian company? Who's actually behind it?
It's a Panamanian company. It's a very large, new, and I say that within the last 18 months, development, well-appointed, good amenities.
Okay. And why have you decided to invest there?
To your point that you made already, it's an up-and-coming destination, an international crossroads. Definitely lots of room for growth in the future. There's been rumors going on for the last 4 or 5 years about Disney eventually building a property there, so there's all kinds of good reasons.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that you should, you know, go with care. Make sure that you have a lawyer who speaks English and understands international law. Read the contract.
Right.
I assume you're not buying on a coast.
No, we are buying on the coast.
You are buying on the coast.
Yep.
So be very careful there, because coasts can be nationalized in Latin American countries.
Mm-hmm.
There are some dangers of where you can actually buy on the coast, and if you're actually buying or you're doing a long-term lease, that you may want to just be aware of. Not saying not to do it, just you want to be aware of it.
Mm-hmm.
And make sure that you take all of those precautions, and I would want you to work with a lawyer there and probably one in the U.S. who could help you understand how it might affect your U.S. taxes. Are you planning on giving up U.S. citizenship?
First of all, we already do have lawyers that we've been talking to already, so again, good suggestions. We're right in line with that. Giving up citizenship is a possibility in the future, but it's not something we're currently looking at.
Okay. So I think you'll probably find the financing you're interested in from the development itself. I don't know that there would be anybody in the U.S. who'd be willing to finance it.
Yeah.
If you have other kinds of capital in the U.S. that you think might help you secure the property without a mortgage, that's probably what you'd want to do. But, you know, as long as it sounds like you're doing all the right steps and making all the right moves, and a 2 to 3 year mortgage down there, hopefully you're going to have the rent that you need to pay that down and pay it off. Sounds like a reasonable thing, but I would check with the property first and see if they offer the kind of financing that you would find doable.
Yeah, we've already had that discussion, and they do not offer any. So, hence the reason we're trying to find something possibly somewhere else.
Then it's, I think, your own U.S. investments. So one possibility is, do you have an IRA?
Yes, but more broad portfolio of different investments that we'd have to liquidate.
Right. So you could liquidate those, move it into a self-directed IRA, and then the IRA would buy the property in Panama for you. And basically you'd be self-financing out of your IRA.
Yeah.
That may be one good way to go.
Okay.
But, you know, you're going to have to look at your total. You and I haven't had a chance to really investigate your total portfolio, but it seems to me that if you can't secure reasonable financing anywhere else, then you turn to yourself and say, what can I do here? Because even if you pay yourself back 7%, it's all going back into the pot.
Mm-hmm.
And you have more control than if you're doing an offshore investment company.
Right. Okay, Elise. Well, thank you.
Well, you're welcome, Jim. Good luck. And I hope it works out. 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. So I want to talk a little bit about what got announced Friday from FICO, Fair Isaacs Corporation. They're the ones who invented the credit score. And what they basically do is they have these different versions of credit score algorithms that they sell or license to various lenders. And so they've got lenders out there who are most lenders are at either FICO 7, I think, or FICO 6, maybe FICO 7. That's the version of the algorithm. FICO 8 has not been widely adopted, and the one that they just announced is, I think, FICO 9. So most lenders are working on an algorithm that's several generations back. And it's not like every year they introduce a new one. Excuse me. And you think to yourself, well, is the new one new and improved? It might be. But what happens is it takes these lenders years to actually run through risk mitigation the new score, and they have to basically run existing loan portfolios against the new score and then compare it to the existing score to see how they perform. And that's why it's not like buying the latest pair of jeans. You really have to plan for this, and it can take a long time. And if they don't feel that the new score algorithm works as effectively as the existing one, then they don't change it. And that's why so many lenders are using older scores, right? But one of the things that's happened over the last 7 years is that there are some 64 million U.S. consumers who have at least one medical debt on their credit report. And that medical debt could have happened because they didn't pay their medical bills, or because they have a dispute, or because there's something going on with the insurance companies. And so this amount of money is just kind of, and some of it is that they got sick and they didn't have insurance. But a lot of times what happens is people get these small medical bills on their credit. They either don't realize it's there, or they think it's in dispute with the insurer, and the insurer says, no, you have to pay it. And they're like, no, you have to pay it. And this can go on for a couple of years. Well, it doesn't get paid, but it gets reported as a non-paid bill, can go to collections, and it can have a seriously damaging effect on your credit. And so on Friday, Fair Isaacs Corporation, which says that lenders use their score 90% of the time for consumer and mortgage lending decisions, they will start penalizing people less in FICO 9, which is the new version of the algorithm that nobody has taken yet, right? So FICO 9 is going to penalize less for medical bills. And this could actually boost the credit scores of a whole lot of people, millions of Americans, and that would give you better access to loans, at less costly loans, less points, less lower interest rates. So it could be a game changer, but it depends on how many people actually are being penalized unfairly. So the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau, CFPB, in May criticized credit scoring models for applying too much weight to unpaid medical debt. And that was based on 5 million anonymous records. And this is, you know, supposed to have a real game-changing effect. And we will see if it actually does change the game. But there's some other stuff going on with FICO credit scores that we should talk about. And if you've got credit questions, you can certainly give me a call at 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, credit. Yours, mine, ours, and what's going on with all the different credit scores you're seeing out there on the Elise Kling Show. Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours on WSB. It's 55 minutes past the hour on the Elise Kling Show. Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours on WSB. 404-872-0750. 1-800-WSB-TALK. Bonnie joins me on the line from Lawrenceville. Hi, Bonnie.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. Let me take you off speaker. I was in the car. Hold on a minute. I'm having a hard time doing this.
Well, that's okay. We can hear you pretty well. How are things going in your world?
Well, they're going great. We moved here 2 years ago, bought a ranch home that we love. It's about 2,600 square feet. It's an older home, 25 years old, but most of it is updated. It has a partially finished basement that includes a large great room and a beautiful finished bath, another finished area that's not real big, but it has a separate entrance, a separate garage. We are currently using it for office space, but we know as we get older we may want to rent out that space.
Mm-hmm.
And stay in the home. My question to you has to do with this smaller interior space that possibly could be made into a small kitchen.
Okay.
And we just don't know whether it's really worth it to invest that much money to bring in the plumbing and everything that it would take to add a kitchen. Would it be really appropriate for rental property or advantageous, I guess? And even renting out a basement apartment, is that something that's done much here? just anything you can tell us in regards to the value of all that.
Well, so Bonnie, one of the things that you have to think about is what is going on in the rest of your neighborhood and what does zoning permit you to do?
So, in my
neighborhood, for example, you can't really build a second kitchen in the house. What you can do is build a snack station. Snack station is a fancy word for another kitchen, except it doesn't have a stove. It has a warming oven. It has a microwave. It has a refrigerator and a wine cooler and a sink and whatever, but it doesn't have a stove. That's the differentiation. And if you were going to build this sort of kitchenette, let's call it, or a snack station, you'd have to see if zoning would approve it. Have you looked into zoning yet?
No, we have not. We live in a neighborhood that has no covenant, so that part, I don't know whether we still have to look at the zoning. We're in the county, not
yeah.
The
you would have to look at whatever zoning sort of oversees that. And so the trick is, what is everybody else in the area doing? If everybody else in the area has this kind of rental space that they have across, you know, over the garage or wherever it is, this extra space, and you've got other people in the area who are renting it out and there is a demand for the rental, you could probably do it. If not, then you could think about doing an Airbnb, which does not require a permanent rental, but would allow you to rent out the extra space whenever you would want to rent it out, if anybody would actually want that. I think the bottom line is, do you want to have somebody living there full time? Can you legally have somebody living there full time? And if not legally, would anybody want to live there without a full-size kitchen? And how would you get around that? And those are some questions that you'd be best off asking your local real estate agent, the one who sold you the house, who could probably give you an eye on what's going on in other parts of the area. And then also speaking with a real estate attorney who could tell you legally what you have to do to comply. And then you can decide what you want to do. But until you do that, Airbnb might not be a bad way to raise some extra cash. 404-872-0750. Stay tuned. We're going to parse through more of the credit issues coming back next on the Elise Glink Show. Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours on WSB.
When she was 18, her father gave her the advice she needed to follow her dreams and become a writer. The next day, he had a heart attack and died in her arms. She did become a writer and a business owner and then a wife and mother. Today, after 13 books, a million of them in print, she's an award-winning syndicated columnist, a radio and TV host, and the owner of two successful companies. And now, Elise is here to help you rebuild your life. Stay tuned. This is gonna be good. This is the Elise Glink Show, rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours.
12:07 this Sunday morning. Well, I guess now it's Sunday afternoon on the Elise Glink Show, rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours in WSB. Our number, 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. Online with Twitter, follow me there, find out what we're talking about, at Glink, at G-L-I-N-K. Sign up for the free weekly newsletter at thinklink.com. And if you're interested in buying investment real estate, we've been talking a little bit about it today, you can go to thinklinkstore.com and check out my Intentional Investor Series, How to Be Wildly Successful in Real Estate. Use the discount code WSB Radio and get 75% off. 404-872-0750. Seth joins me on the line all the way from Nashville. Hi, Seth.
Hi.
How are you?
Very good. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What's going on?
I sold a house recently that I purchased in 2010, and I made some money on the house, and I'm getting some conflicting information. This is the first house I sold, and I just was hoping you could clarify that I could keep the profits to the house without being capital gains taxed. I moved to Nashville. I'm currently renting.
Okay, let's back up a little bit. So you bought a house in 2010. How much did you pay for the house?
$230,000.
Okay, and how much did you sell it for?
I sold it for $340,000. I made a lot of money on it.
That's great. And when did you sell it?
I closed on it July 25th of this year.
Okay, terrific. So you roughly, and the $340,000, how much did you net out?
About $140,000. And
well, that's not. Oh wait, if you bought it for $230,000 and you sold for $340,000, the most that you could have net out would be $110,000.
Right. Yes. That's what it was. And my mortgage was, I owed about $202,000 on my mortgage.
Okay.
So.
And so you've netted $110,000, but then you had costs of purchase and costs of sale, right?
Right.
So, regardless, if you are single and you sell a home that you have lived in for 24 months, you can keep up to $250,000 in profits tax-free. Now, you netted $110,000, and then you have to subtract the expenses of purchase and sale, which my guess, after you do the broker's commission and transfer taxes and any of the other 37,000 kinds of expenses, you probably netted out less than $100,000. So you're nowhere near the $250,000. And if you're married, you and your spouse can keep up to $500,000 in profits tax-free as long as you've lived there for 24 months and you haven't taken the exclusion more than once not at all the last 24 months.
Great. Well,
who has been giving you bad advice? Because you clearly haven't gone to IRS.gov.
Well, I got an article from my realtor that said, you know, they confirmed what you're saying, but my boss that's been in this house for a long time was saying that really what you need to do is roll it into another house to avoid the capital gains tax.
Okay, can I just tell you that advice is something like 15 years old?
Right. Well,
no, I mean, I'm not even, this isn't hyperbole. I mean that when, I'm trying to even think of which presidential election, it was like, you know, Clinton and Dole, maybe. And that's where that got changed. And so if you look at IRS.gov, and if you look at publication, I think it's number 523, sale of your house, it will describe that you can keep up to $250,000 in profits tax-free as an individual or up to $500,000 in profits tax-free if you sell and you're married. So your boss is like 15 years out of date.
Got it.
But don't tell him that because then you might have problems at work.
That's right.
So instead, what you may want to do, because there is no requirement that you buy a replacement property. He is talking about something called the rollover replacement rule. So what you don't want to do is ever tell your boss that he's a complete moron, because that just doesn't go over well, right? But what you might want to do is say to him, you know, I wonder if you're thinking about the 1031 tax exchange rule, where when you sell an investment property, you do have to, if you want to defer, it's not avoid taxes, you're deferring your capital gains taxes by buying a replacement property that costs as much as the old one. And that one is still in effect. You do need to set up a 1031.
Breaking news from the WSB 24-hour news desk.
And this is Edgar Tragus. Following the developments out of Northern California now this afternoon, following the 6.0 magnitude earthquake that struck about 3:30 local time in the San Francisco Bay Area region, especially hit, we're learning now more and more in the last couple of hours, is the Napa County and Napa region. Let's dip in now to a press conference with officials in that county and city.
Out, as was mentioned by the city manager, where our resources are exhausted as far as quantity of on-duty personnel. So in these situations, as happens state and nationally, we call.
You're listening to John Callahan. He is Napa Fire Battalion Chief.
In the neighborhood of, we have right about probably 100 plus gas leaks, power lines down. Medical calls are in the neighborhood of about 80 plus at this time. The Queen of the Valley Hospital has been inundated with patients, all related to the trauma-related incidences after the earthquake. One major incident of a fireplace falling on a young child, a young person, is in critical condition, has been flown out for a neuro center. Our crews, again, are still, we're trying to catch up with the calls. We have a significant backlog of calls. We also additionally have resources from the California Office of Emergency Services on hand, local fire agencies with rescue crews. The specialized urban search and rescue crews are en route here, plus some that are physically in town now. That's about all I have. The Public Works Director is going to come up and talk about the infrastructure issues and go from there.
Okay, we'll jump out here and we'll keep monitoring this press conference from Napa, California. But as you heard, at least one critical injury from this earthquake that struck around 3:30 local time this morning in Northern California, Napa region, about 6 miles southwest of Napa is where the epicenter of this earthquake is. We'll keep you up to date on details as we go on through the afternoon. For now, though, Edgar Tragetts in the WSB 24-Hour News Center.
It is 12:15 on the Elise Kling Show, Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours on WSB, 404-872-0750. We're going to stay with earthquake coverage. It's terrible. I was in Napa about a year and a half ago, right exactly where this earthquake was, and it is some of the most beautiful country in this entire country, in this entire coast-to-coast land of the United States. So we'll stay with the coverage as it continues to unfold during the day. I was on the phone with Seth, who recently sold his home, and found out that he's getting some questionable advice from his boss about how much in profits that he can keep when he sells. He netted $110,000 from his house that he sold. And I'm just telling him that I think one way to approach this with your boss, because you never really want to tell your boss that he doesn't know what he's talking about, because that always just doesn't go over well. And as a boss, I can tell you I don't love it when my people tell me that, even if when they're right. So I would just say to him, oh, that was such great advice. I assume you meant the 1031 tax-free exchange, but because this wasn't a rental property and I'm not going to buy another rental property, it probably doesn't apply for me. But thank you so much for that advice. And I think that's how I would couch it with him, because if you can steer him away or make him think that what he's talking about is actually a much more complicated 1031 tax-free exchange, but it doesn't apply to you because in your world, you know, you're selling a personal residence and not buying another personal residence, maybe you can move him a little towards the truth. What do you think?
I think that's great advice, and I'll probably be able to keep my job. But I just had one more question. You know, if you were in my shoes, just based on this limited information on my portfolio, I've got the $110,000 that I made on the house in a savings account, and I've got about $50,000 in my 401k, you know, about $40,000 in a traditional Roth IRA. I'm 37. I'm single. And you know, I foresee staying in Nashville and buying a house in Nashville within the next 10 months. Would you put that back into a house, or would you maybe do something else with it?
You know, I think you should. I would probably not put all of it into a house. Nashville's got some really reasonably priced property, and I think if you're going to be in Nashville for a while, and only you know this, but if you're going to be in Nashville for maybe 5 to 10 years, I might divide the money and buy two properties. One I would live in, and I would try to make it as, you know, reasonably priced as possible. And the other one I might do is buy an investment property where you actually would need a 1031 tax-free exchange. So you can tell your boss that that's what you've been investigating for the next purchase. But I would think about it because, you know, if you're single and you've got some, you know, you're making more money than you actually need, buying an investment property or buying a house and fixing it up and then selling it or renting it out can be a great place to diversify your portfolio. And while you have about $100,000 between your 401k and your IRA, you know, it's not really a lot. So this money that you've got here, you'd really want to make it work harder for you. And mortgage interest rates are at all-time lows. So if you buy property today, what's going to end up happening is if you're going to stay there for the next 10 years, you're going to find that this property grows in value, but the costs are going to be locked in at a very low rate, 3.5%. And you're going to be able to continue to increase the amount that you get back. And so you're going to get back that money in a couple of different ways and have somebody else help you pay down those mortgages. And in the end, you're going to end up with a lot more money and then be able to continue to invest that to grow. And I'd look into that as much as I would look into investing in the stock market. You do want to be fully diversified. So stay in touch, Seth. Let me know how it goes. 404-872-0750. I'm Elise Klink. Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours on WSB. It's 25 minutes past the hour on the Elise Kling Show, Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours on WSB. Our number, 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. It's time to do our prize pack. We have a four-pack of VIP tickets to the 31st Annual Fall Atlanta Home Show, September 5th through the 7th at the Cobb Galleria Center, and a pair of tickets to see the Tedeschi Trucks Band in concert, September 12th at Chastain Park Amphitheater, produced by ASO Presents, and a pair of tickets to see the Dream Car Exhibition now through September 14th at the High Museum of Art. The prize pack value, $220. We're going to give it away to the, I guess we'll do the fifth caller at the prize pack line. 404-741-0750. 404-741-0750. Good luck. Remember, you can only win once every 30 days. I know that seems crazy that we would have people that would try, really, but these are great prize packs, right? So we have people trying to get in a little bit more often. So anyway, once every 30 days, set 404-741-0750. It's 26 minutes past the hour on the Elise Kling Show. Just wanted to circle back on what's going on with the FICO 9. So I talked about this earlier last hour, that FICO, which is about 90% of all mortgage lenders and creditors use the FICO score to determine whether or not you're credit worthy. And you've heard me talk about it for 15 years, and Clark talks about it all the time. Well, the reality is that every few years, FICO reinvents its algorithm, and it puts more or less weight on different issues. And right now, the issue that they're looking at is medical bills. And 64 million Americans have medical bills that have popped up on their credit and are affecting the credit score. But the CFPB has just, after looking at 5 million anonymous files, is wondering whether they should be putting so much emphasis on it. And so the new FICO 9, which is the new version of this that was introduced on Friday, is going to put less emphasis on medical bills. And that could mean a big change to you, but only if lenders use FICO 9. There's also going to be other kinds of changes coming to FICO pretty soon, where your rent is going to be able to, how well you pay rent, not just a mortgage, but rent will affect positively or negatively your credit score. There are all kinds of changes coming to the world of credit, and you're going to want to stay tuned to understand how it's going to affect you. I'll have more information on thinklink.com for that and on expertrealestatetips.com, so stay tuned for that. In the meantime, we'll take your questions next on the Elise Kling Show. Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours on WSB.
Join us Monday for Atlanta's Morning News. Jamie Dupree is live in Washington. We'll follow up with the situation of Ferguson, Missouri. Michael Brown's funeral is set for Monday. And we'll talk about a break in the heat and the five-day forecast. First thing Monday morning on WSB.
It's 12:36 on the Elise Kling Show, Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours on WSB. The phone number, 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK, at Glink on Twitter, at GLINK. There's thinklinkstore.com, thinklinkstore.com, thinklink.com, expertrealestatetips.com. It's a whole universe of Glink stuff out there. 404-872-0750 is our number. Just want to give you a little bit of a heads up. I'll repeat this again. Next week, we've got the kickoffs of the Dogs versus the Clemson Tigers. It's the beginning of football season, and as longtime listeners know, that means our show moves back an hour. We go from 11 to 1 to 12 to 2, and that's where we're going to start next week, 12 o'clock. Lunchtime will be the lunch hour. However, the following week, I think we're back at our 11 to 1 time because it's an off week. Dogs are on, and then they're off, and then they're on for a whole bunch of weeks, and then sometime, I guess, in October, November, we'll have another week of moving backwards. But it's that time of year, fall, kids going back to school, kids going off to college, and football starting, and that means that the Dogs are playing the Clemson Tiger. Next week's kickoff, I think, is at 5:30, but the coverage starts a whole lot earlier in the afternoon. You may see some other changes in the lineup, like Dave Baker may appear on a Sunday instead of on a Saturday. There's all kinds of crazy stuff that goes on in WSB. You'll just have to stay tuned to get the latest. 404-872-0750. It's 12:38. Patricia joins me on the line from Atlanta. Hi, Patricia.
Hello. I had a question about reporting on credit reports of late mortgage and HELOC payments. I had a HELOC that was sold from Wachovia to Wells Fargo and a mortgage that was sold within a month of the closing to Wells Fargo. And I was always current on my payments until I had an illness and a job loss. And I fell behind, and I had four missed payments, and then I entered an agreement where it was catching up. And then I reached a point where I couldn't do it, and I had two missed payments and was foreclosed on very, very quickly. I put in a forbearance thing. It was ignored, and I had a rapid foreclosure. On my credit report currently, I see three listings for late payments on mortgage. Two listings for late payments on mortgage and two listings for late payment on HELOC from two different entities. And then just recently, last month, Credit Karma notified me of a new listing for a late payment on the HELOC, but I haven't had that HELOC for many months. And I'm wondering what's going on and how those things are listed and what I should be doing to, you know, address this.
So Credit Karma pulls from the three credit reporting bureaus, and I am not sure what it is you're actually seeing because I'm not looking at it, but the information is interesting. What you may want to do is go to annualcreditreport.com and pull a copy for free of each of your credit histories.
Yeah, I'm going to do that. Yeah.
Equifax, TransUnion, and Experian.
Right.
Take a look at the detailed listing, and to actually see it online, which you'd want to do and maintain it, you'll probably have to set up accounts with each of them. But that's okay. You can do that. And then you'll be able to go back over a month and see your credit history. Otherwise, it just appears in your window. You can print it, and that's it. That's pretty much how they do it.
Mm-hmm.
But I would go and take a look and see who's reporting it and where it differs. And then if it's true that – so sometimes what happens when you have your house foreclosed on is that the main mortgage is foreclosed but not the HELOC, home equity line of credit.
Mm-hmm.
So that may still be out there, and you have to see if that's actually true and if it is out there. If the HELOC,
well, it was foreclosed. They were both with Wells Fargo, and it occurred together simultaneously. This was 2 years ago. Within
the
window,
do you have the paperwork that says that they were both foreclosed on?
I'd have to go back and look.
Okay, you're going to have to go back and look then, because you have to find the paperwork that shows that it was foreclosed on both
mm-hmm.
of them, and that it was taken away.
Right.
So that you can go back to the three credit reporting bureaus, whoever's reporting it, and file a dispute saying, no, this was actually foreclosed on 2 years ago, and I'm not sure where this is coming from, but you have 30 days. And then you file a formal dispute with them. And you may have to file it a couple of times because it may take them a little bit longer. They're going to have to go back to Wells Fargo and say, did you foreclose on this? And Wells Fargo is going to have to look and say, yes, we did, and this was the date. But it's unclear to me where that is actually coming from. Now, there are other ways. So let's say this goes on for a couple of months and you're not getting any satisfaction. A couple of things that you can do. Number one, you can go to the CFPB.gov site, Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, CFPB.gov.
Mm-hmm.
And you can file a complaint with them. You can also go to the Facebook pages of each of the credit reporting bureaus, or the one that's actually responsible for reporting this.
Mm-hmm.
And you can file a complaint or just raise it to their attention on the Facebook page, because those seem to, and in Twitter feeds, because those seem to get a little bit more attention, and just ask for help.
Mm-hmm.
And then the help will come back to you, and you may get around some of the bureaucracy.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because the whole goal here is to try and fix the problem. Now, what have you done in the last 2 years since this was foreclosed? Have you been able to rent a different place? Are you back employed again? Are you
I was staying with family. I'm back employed again. All my bills are current. I'm getting my life back together, basically. But I went to get a car. My car died and all this. I went to get a car, and I had, you know, my rates were high for both the car loan and the insurance. I went to, I've had trouble, some trouble with trying to rent an apartment with, being refused because of my credit score, which I know is in the low 600s right now.
Okay. So you need to start by going to annualcreditreport.com, and you need to start to clean up whatever's going on there.
Mm-hmm.
And that can take you some months, but hopefully it'll be worth it, because then it should roll back to 2 years ago, and then the kind of new stuff that's popping up should disappear, and then over the next month after that, you should start to see your credit score rise. Because once things like foreclosures are 2, 3, 4, and 5 years in the past, then your score starts to rise as long as all of your other bills are current. And I'm not saying you're going to be at 750 or 800 anytime soon.
Right.
I don't think you will be. But no. If you can get out of the low 600s, that's a good thing.
Right. No, I always was in the 750s, and it's been sort of a disaster. But
and listen, a lot of people, Patricia, had disasters in the last 7 or 8 years. There are millions of Americans, 10 million, who are still underwater with their mortgages.
Mm-hmm.
There are people who are going to spend the next 30 years digging their way out of what happened over the course of 2007 to 2010.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if that's any small comfort to you, but you are walking in the same shoes of millions of Americans, and for many of them, the recession has never ended.
Oh, I know. It's been a very difficult time for so many people. But I just was unclear as to whether one mortgage could be listed, like, as three separate accounts. You know,
well, you can have it as two accounts, but if the HELOC was sold from Wachovia to Wells Fargo,
mm-hmm.
it's possible that all the paperwork didn't transfer, right? Mm-hmm. Wachovia basically was bought by Wells Fargo.
Right.
So if they're listing you as being late when you were with Wachovia and late with Wells Fargo, it may appear to you that it's being listed three different times. But it may not be. So that's why you have to go to the Experian, Equifax, and TransUnion, pull those copies, and see how it's listed on each one. And it may be that some sort of error has happened. I mean, errors happen all the time because
mm-hmm.
the information that is uploaded is not always accurate. It is not always 100% new, updated information. In fact, when I pulled a copy of my mother's credit history, she has really good credit, but they were showing bills from like 6 months ago. Her latest credit card statement wasn't current. So there was some glitch in the system that had to get worked through to actually show her current balance on her mortgage and, you know, her other things. So it's possible that there's some sort of a weird glitch. And by calling it to their attention, that you're going to be able to get it fixed. And once it's fixed, it'll route through the rest of the systems as well. Or at least it should. Maybe you have to file disputes with each of the credit reporting bureaus and just stay on top of it. But I would expect to spend the next 2 to 3 months doing this
mm-hmm.
and trying coming to the bottom of it.
So I should work with the credit bureaus and not go to Wells Fargo, because working with them was extremely difficult.
I would start with the credit reporting bureaus, and then by filing a dispute, you're forcing them to go back, and you've got the proof. You've got to go find your proof that these were both foreclosed on.
Mm-hmm.
So there couldn't possibly be any current information. Now, the only one thing I will say is that you have to guard against fraud. So is there somebody who's taken out a HELOC, supposedly in your name, that's fraudulent,
mm-hmm.
or there's some other fraud going on in your account? That's a whole different conversation.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Mm-hmm.
So that could be happening as well. And I know people who have stolen other people's identities, gone out mm-hmm. and gotten mortgages, stripped the mortgage of the value, and then left the person with a worthless mortgage on property they don't own, and it was a big mess to try and entangle. That took several years to untangle.
Mm-hmm.
But so you have to make sure that there's not fraud going on as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, when house was foreclosed on, I worked at the attorney's office and called. It was a Fannie Mae mortgage, so I called Fannie Mae and I said, you know, when do I have to vacate the property? And they said, well, you know, you'll get something in the mail. We'll let you know. And I was ill, and I was staying with my family, not at the property, but all my belongings were there. The property was not rekeyed. I went back out to the property, and the property was rekeyed, and all my belongings were gone.
Right.
And I never. And Fannie Mae said, I worked with the Fannie Mae people. They said that they didn't do that, that they had been out to the property and seen that it was occupied and all the belongings were in there. And apparently Wells Fargo, who Fannie Mae said had no right to go to the property at that point, went out there. And I was told by somebody at some subsidiary at Wells Fargo that my family had moved my belongings out of the property, but that never happened.
So they were lying to you, not a big, huge surprise, and you've lost all of your belongings, and you probably have some sort of legal action against Wells Fargo for doing that, but you'd have to have your documentation in order. You'd have to have all your details, the names of people, and all the rest. You can file a complaint against Wells Fargo for this at helpwithmybank.gov. Helpwithmybank.gov. It's the OCC, which regulates all the big lenders in the country, including Wells Fargo, and then their people will start to investigate from their end. Good luck, Patricia. Let me know what happens. It's 49 minutes past the hour on the Elise Glink Show, Rebuilding America One House at a Time, starting with yours on WSB.
Try to stay cool this weekend and join us early for Atlanta's Morning News Monday. I'm Scott Slade. We'll check traffic every 6 minutes, and Kirk Mellish's 5-day forecast will help you plan the week, a break in the heat, and the best rain chance days Monday morning on WSB.
It's 12:56 on the Elise Glink Show, Rebuilding America One House at a Time on WSB, 404-872-0750. So one piece of news this week that I thought was really positive is that in June, and I know it's a couple of months ago, but that's the latest numbers, in June, distressed sales, which includes foreclosed REO homes and short sales, accounted for just 11.4% of total home sales. And this number, according to CoreLogic, is the lowest share since December of 2007, and a huge improvement from this time a year ago when distressed sales made up 15.8%, almost 16% of total sales. We've dropped down to 11.4%. Now, within the category, REOs are about 7.2% and short sales are 4.2%. And let's just remember back to what the height of the market, the worst peak. We had distressed sales in January of 2009 at 32.5% of all sales, with foreclosed homes making up 28%. So we've gone from 32% down to 11%. Now, that said, there's still some states where distressed sales are way out of whack, right? So Michigan still had the largest share of distressed sales of any state. 27% of all sales is distressed. Illinois, 24.1%. Florida, 23.6%, Nevada, 22.7%, and Georgia, 20.7%, almost 21% of all sales in Georgia were distressed properties, foreclosures, and short sales. Now, California is doing a whole lot better, and that's great, but Chicago, Naperville, Arlington Heights, Illinois, which is kind of the southwestern portion of Chicago metro area, had the largest share at 27.4% of all sales. So Georgia, unfortunately, is still not out of the market, not out of the woods yet, but the market is improving, and that's good news. And when we talk about rebuilding America one house at a time, this is what we're talking about. State by state, community by community, block by block, neighborhood by neighborhood. Almost every home selling right now is helping to rebuild America. I'll be back next week. Don't forget, we've got football starting. The Dogs are playing the Clemson Tigers on Saturday night at 5:30. Our coverage begins around 1:30. I will be back a little bit after that on Sunday, so we're moving back to 12 o'clock on Sunday. So tune in then for the Elise Glink Show. Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours on WSB. Have a great week, everybody.